Welcome to Talking to Grandma, a weekly podcast that elevates stories, science, and strategies to help you raise and teach multilingual and bilingual children. I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides, founder and CEO of Bilingual Generation, an organization that helps children with bilingualism in their bones stay connected to their heritage languages and cultures. I'm also a Harvard-educated doctora who has experienced losing, recovering, and passing on my heritage language to my children. Whether you are a parent, grandparent, teacher, researcher, school leader, or simply someone interested in the topics of language learning and language preservation, this podcast is for you. Through interviews with amazing guests and solo episodes, you will find the resources, guidance, and strategies needed to support you in your journey. Let's get started. In today's episode, we speak with the insightful, witty, and humble Connor P. Williams. In our conversation, he shares his research on expanding equitable and multilingual learning opportunities for young, linguistically diverse children in the United States.
When these linguistic and cultural resources, these strengths, these amazing wealth of value that kids bring in from both sides of the house, once those become something that we treat as a matter of consumption, something to get access to and to take on and to absorb and to use for our own purposes only, that's colonization, right?
Dr. Connor P. Williams is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation and a partner at the Children's Equity Project. His research focuses on expanding equitable and multilingual learning opportunities for young, linguistically diverse children in the United States. He has three children, all of whom attend public schools in Washington, D.C. Stick around to hear us discuss the colonization of dual language programs and the importance of equity and access in these spaces. Welcome to the show, Connor. It is an honor to speak with you today. I'm so happy that you accepted our invitation. And I want to start today's conversation with your story. Your research focuses on expanding equitable and multilingual learning opportunities for young, linguistically diverse children in the United States. Where did the motivation for this research come from? There are so many different topics and research agendas to explore. So why did you pick this one?
So look, some of it was an accident, to be honest. I finished my PhD over a decade ago, and I got a job doing early education policy. And one of the things I was working on was young dual language learners or English learning kids. I was doing a lot of other things. It just happened to be the thing that as I was writing about it, got more and more attention. And eventually we got a couple of funders who were interested in growing that work. So I began thinking about English learners more fully because it was just the thing that took off. And then I had kids, and they showed up in here in DC in a public school, in a Title I dual language immersion school. It was a school that was at the time 7 or 8% white, overwhelmingly Spanish dominant, and at least 45% of the current students were English learners at the moment, and another 20% had been English learners before. It was over 80% free and reduced price lunch, and yet Washington, D.C., where I live, is a place where gentrification of the city and colonization of dual language programs was kind of visible, you know, many years ago when this was happening. And I watched it as I was seeing this school start to get a lot more like my family demographically, a lot more English dominant kids, a lot more highly educated, upper middle class parents. I wrote a piece about this and I sent it and pitched it and landed it at the Atlantic about how dual language programs can be this wonderful spur for integration and for equity. And they can also eventually tip over into that kind of colonization. And beyond my wildest dreams, I mean, this piece went viral is not accurate, but it was the most read thing at the Atlantic for it got days. I mean, it was unbelievable. In December 2017, when, if you remember the politics of the United States in December 2017, there was a lot of fresh hell in the news. And somehow everybody wanted to read about colonizing bilingual and dual language programs. So that was kind of how it got started, is that I kept on stumbling into what seemed to me interesting stuff, and that kept on taking off. So since that time, I've been obsessed with this question and been continuing to try to dig into it.
Wow. Thanks so much for sharing that. I really want to dig into the colonization of dual language programs. Why you use the word colonization, right? Because there's so many different people who kind of tiptoe around that word. And it seems like there's a lot of intentionality behind the use of that word and the implications of it. Speaking of intentionality of language, I came across your work, not through that article, which seems like probably the way that I would have, but I read one of your reports called Ensuring Equitable Access to Dual Language Immersion Programs from the Century Foundation. And we'll link this in the show notes along with the article in The Atlantic for folks to see. And I'd love to dig into that report with you if that's okay, so we can kind of elevate some of the key themes for our listeners. But one of the things that really, I'll start with this, speaking of language, one of the things that really kind of stood out to me in the report is the use of language. When I was reading it, I was seeing terms like high potential, skilled, talented to describe English learners. And I'm a part of the community that you described in this report. And growing up, we were never referred to as high potential, skilled, or talented. We were referred to as at risk or disadvantaged. And even as a child, I was aware of this language and it impacted my sense of self. It impacted my value. It impacted how I felt about my cultural and linguistic resources. So can you share a little bit about the power of language that we use as researchers, policymakers, caregivers, and educators?
Yeah, sure. I'm really grateful that you detected that in that report. I mean, this report was our effort to put data on what was this sort of sense I had when I wrote that article for The Atlantic. Is we couldn't really prove it. Nobody had done the research, but somebody had to and decided it was going to be me. That kind of language around taking an asset-based frame and taking a strength-based view of these kids is, I think, implicit in the best of what dual language immersion can be, right? I mean, that's at its core what it offers that other bilingual education models have not historically done, right? Where it says this isn't just about language as a way to get access to content, academic content, or as a way to get access to knowledge. This is about language as something that is intrinsically valuable in and of itself. And thereby, in the best of these programs, which are linguistically integrated, where you've got native Vietnamese speakers and native English speakers learning in both languages together, or native Spanish speakers and native English speakers learning both languages together, or in other countries, right, native French speakers and native Hmong speakers learning in both languages together, fill in the blank. The implication is that everybody is bringing cultural and linguistic assets that are worth it, that are valuable, and that other communities ought to learn from and ought to want to learn from. And this is where the colonization part comes in, though, right? Is that when these linguistic and cultural resources, these strengths, these amazing wealth of value that kids bring in from both sides of the house, once those become something that we treat as a matter of consumption, something to get access to and to take on and to absorb and to use for our own purposes only, that's colonization, right? The thing about dual language programs, the reason that we use the word colonization in there is that there's definitely a subset, and I want to be clear, I'm going to use details from who I am, because I am caricaturing myself here, right? That they are Prius driving, New Yorker reading, studied abroad in Barcelona, and it's through some sort of Stockholm syndrome thing, have invented and developed a sense of themselves that includes Spanish, or it includes French. And they have a deep urge to pass that down to their children, preferably in a way that's easier and more effective than their own studying it from middle school on. So they are oftentimes, and not always with bad intentions, in fact, almost never with bad intentions, willing to throw their elbows as hard and as wide as they can to secure access to these programs, using language about how it's because they care about the diversity of the school, or they want their kids to be global citizens. But fundamentally, they want their kids to be in these schools to get something that they can then take with them and monetize even, or to that they can take with them and deliver some kind of sense of self that the parents are trying to pass down. And that strikes me like just very much as a colonial enterprise. But that's why we're using that language. And the one last thing I'll say is that there's also a technical distinction we wanted to make sure of, which is that the gentrification is a well-established theme and research area for housing and space and neighborhood. Colonization felt like a useful word to use in this case to distinguish a neighborhood changing versus a school's demographics changing. So the colonization was for the school and gentrification was for the neighborhood, we decided.
Because those two are just kind of hand in hand. So I like the distinction, but also the relation between it. And as you're describing the type of profile of the well-intentioned, the non kind of native or heritage speaking person, generally white family, upper middle class, has access to things, very well-intentioned and very nice, but also there maybe is an unwillingness or a blindness, or I'm not really sure what to name it, to recognize the harm
that's being caused by those actions. And I think about when I first kind of came across this was when I was in my master's program at Fordham University through the Teach for America cohort, which kind of had this, you know, very specific type of teacher profile that was there. And one of my classmates, who was white, upper middle class, well off, studied abroad in high school in Barcelona, was speaking Spanish fluently. And I was like, where did you do that? And she's like, oh yeah, I like went to Spanish immersion school since middle school, and I studied abroad in Barcelona. And I felt this rage that I could not explain, because my parents just one generation earlier were like physically punished for speaking Spanish. And I could not get a grasp on the language at that point. I didn't speak it. I felt all the shame around it. And then to see somebody else just speak it with such ease and to use it to navigate her life even more, it was this dynamic that I couldn't really name. And then, as you mentioned, to see it happening in dual language programs, which are expanding, we hear from a lot of the teachers that we work with or the families that we work with the same type of rage that happens when they see this, when their children, for whatever reason, may have difficulty accessing these programs, whereas other white, well-accessed children are being applauded and supported and lifted up by all of these systems of privilege. So I'm curious to know, what does it take to get through to some of these folks who are colonizing and who are gentrifying with very well intentions but harmful impact, to help them understand and help them become a part of the change that's needed?
I'm going to try to be an optimist. I think that like the honest answer is it is, and again, I'm trying to speak, I want to make clear, I'm not speaking about them so much as us, because this is my tribe. And to a degree, a lot of the research I've been doing has been trying to excavate the degree to which my own actions are the problem. I mean, so I'd say a couple of things. One, I'm pretty pessimistic about my tribe. I don't know that they can be persuaded or that they can be even brought to see necessarily. But let me talk a little about the dynamics here. And partly what I've concluded as a researcher is that the answer is going to have to be a significant expansion of the pie, right? You just have to have a lot more bilingual instruction and dual language instruction around. And I want to also own that the research is pretty clear that the linguistic integration of these dual language programs is what works, so that there is a place for these English dominant families from my family. There's a place for us for in these schools. The research on one-way immersion, right, where you have all these English dominant kids in a class and they're all learning, I don't fill in the blank, you know, French or heck, Latin, it doesn't matter. They're all learning a language that only the teacher speaks with any kind of fluency. It just doesn't work as well as having a community where the academic instruction and the social life of the school are multilingual. That works better. And it works better for the English learning students, the Spanish dominant students in these classes too. The challenge is having policies in place that foster that integration as opposed to allowing, you know, the more privileged to just slowly take over or even rapidly take over a school. So that's some of it, is that you need to grow these programs. We need to grow these programs at the kind of pace that makes it possible for English learners to retain access, to make sure that they can continue to develop their emerging bilingualism from a young age, while there is room or more room for everybody to access these programs too. And so this is part of what this report that we did really plays around with, is trying to find ways to make clear that the sin to be avoided at all costs is what's becoming true in DC, where you have many, many Spanish dominant kids enrolled in English only programs around the city because they've been pushed out of the bilingual settings, whereas the bilingual settings are mostly English dominant. So we're essentially stripping languages from our Spanish dominant community and then adding them to our English dominant community. That has to be avoided. The ways to do that are going to vary by community. If, for instance, when you say one-way dual language immersion in DC or in Utah, you mean all English dominant kids learning in two languages. When you say one-way dual immersion in Texas, you mean a totally different thing. You mean all Spanish dominant children learning in Spanish and English. And so it's going to be a different answer. Like in Dallas is not going to need the same things that Washington, DC is going to need. But the big things are pretty clear. When you grow these programs, you need to reserve seats. and or weight your lotteries towards linguistic diversity, towards Spanish dominant kids, or if it's a Vietnamese program, towards Vietnamese speaking kids, or Mandarin or Cantonese speaking kids, whatever the language of instruction is going to be. Two, and probably even more conclusively or more importantly, we need to have a significant growth of investment in bilingual teacher training pipelines in the United States. So when we talk about diversifying the K-12 teacher workforce, we need to focus on language too, not just race. Partly that's because we have a really effective teacher training and licensure system for reducing teacher diversity that doesn't really correlate to better outcomes for kids. Like, traditional teacher training and licensure isn't super effective at leading to higher quality instruction, but it is really effective at keeping out our non-native speakers of English. So we need to address that. And that would really solve the problem, right? If you had many more bilingual teachers, you could have many more of these programs, and every overeducated, you know, Spanish learning guy named Connor could have room for his kids, and he wouldn't be elbowing as many people because there'd be enough supply. Here's one of the ways I put it sometimes. You say equity crises are always a function of scarcity. Like, there is not an equity crisis for air in the United States. Everybody gets air. Now, we don't all get the same amount of cleanliness of air, and that's an equity problem because we have a scarcity of clean air. There is not an equity crisis in terms of access to K-12 education in the United States. By and large, there's a seat for everyone. It's not always as close as it might need to be. It's not always as good as it should be, but everybody has a seat somewhere. The equity crisis we have in public education is usually about quality, or in this case, about access to the research-based dual language immersion program that we know is best for English learning kids. So one way to ease, and the best way to ease any equity crisis, is to make that issue of scarcity become an issue of abundance.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And I also think that the parallel to air and air cleanliness is really important, because a part of that is connected to our policies and what we allow around air and who influences those policies. And there's a lot of parallels to what's happening with bilingual and dual language education. And if we as kind of electorate or collective were able to push towards these more inclusive or equitable policies, expansive policies, then it would address some of the scarcity that you mentioned, but also the equity issues that inevitably pop up in systems of oppression. I have a question, Connor, as you were talking about growing programs and reserving seats for Spanish dominant speakers. And I don't know if this is even a term or anybody has used it before, but as I was reading the report, I was thinking a lot about language reparations. I saw in the report that, like, you know, we need to reserve seats for Spanish dominant speakers. And that's definitely a large part of the student population, or Mandarin speakers, or, you know, name your heritage language speaker in the dual language program. But there are a lot of families who second, third, sometimes even first generation, who are disconnected from their languages due to systemic oppression. Are there any discussions around reserving those English seats, those English dominant speakers, but who are heritage language speakers, in those spaces as a form of language reparations? And furthermore, like, you know, speaking of heritage languages, African-American students were disconnected from their heritage languages due to the systems of slavery and systemic oppressions. And there are no dual language programs around that. Many people are not aware of what their heritage language is or not connected to it. And they remain significantly underserved by dual language programs or multilingualism. So I'm curious about that discussion around equity and if that's happening and how.
It definitely is happening in some communities. These so-called heritage language programs are a real designation. They do exist. They tend to be in communities very much that you would expect in traditional immigrant gateway communities, states, or regions, where essentially where there's been in migration for a long enough time that the systems of linguistic oppression have had time to sort of take effect across a couple of generations. California is a unique case because they sort of went English only for the better part of 20 years from the late 90s until 2016. And so that's a somewhat more like overt and recent version. Arizona still has their English only mandate on the books there. It's another place. As a policy matter, and I'm not a civil rights lawyer, so I want to be careful that, you know, as a PhD researcher, I have some of the background here I need. I think you would find that it it gets a little bit thornier to reserve seats as a matter of overt heritage language rebuilding, in part because the usually what you're going to need to have in that case is you're relying on probably a race or ethnicity, which is, of course, very difficult to do. You can't set seat quotas based on those. You could try using, you know, parent or grandparent linguistic dominance, but I'm not sure how that would stand up. I think the courts would be dodgy on that. And that's part of what's helpful about the English learner classification and also language dominance at like home language speaking right now is that it has some legal identifiers around it. And in a sort of odd twist of civil rights law, it isn't a protected class in the same way. Like you can set seat quotas based on language in a way that you cannot based on race. So that's some of it. Maybe to put those two things together, what I would say, though, is that the good news out of that is that usually if there is an effort to relaunch, let's say, Spanish language, heritage language acquisition in a rural place in Texas, it tends to not be the play a situation where there's going to be tons of competition and over demand for seats, where the communities where heritage language programs are launching, there's going to be a lot of heritage speakers available, maybe even in schools already. So you may find that it's a different context. And this goes to what I said before. I came to this project from personal and professional experiences in DC, which it turned out in our research was sort of the epicenter for colonization. There's not a lot of other places in the country that have seen more privileged efforts to get their way into dual language program. And so it's just a very different story, language acquisition or bilingualism I said Dallas before, right? Dallas has over 40,000 kids who are English learners and are in dual language programs. That's more, Washington, DC doesn't have 40,000 English learners in it, right? And Dallas has that many in dual language. There are whole states that have fewer than 40,000 English learners. So it's just a very different context. And it's going to, the policies you set and the structures you set are going to have to be geared to your particular community.
Right, right. And I'm familiar with those heritage language kind of programs. I think they're generally at older grades as well. Like dual language programs, you generally see in the early childhood years, and a heritage language program you might see in a middle or high school setting or even at a college level. And it has a different structure and a different approach to learning the language. And speaking of kind of heritage language development and learning, I think there are connections to what you were mentioning about the teacher shortage program. So we are seeing this kind of expansion of dual language programs, which is great because in, you know, a generation or so, we are going to start to see this pipeline question begin to shift because we are, you know, building the capacity of our students from a young age, and there will be more people just who are able to speak their heritage languages or speak more than one language if it's not their heritage language. But we also have had, you know, this English-only policy in different states like California, Massachusetts, like you said, it's still in place in Arizona. It was in place in Texas during my parents' generation. So there are a lot of people who have exposure to their heritage language in the home setting, but not in an academic setting. Can you give, I guess, any advice or additional context around folks who may, you know, be interested in a teacher preparation program, who speak Spanish, but not academically, but who are failing kind of, I know you mentioned we need to provide equitable access for strong Spanish speakers in teacher preparation programs in their native language, which I think is great. And we definitely should do. But we've come across a number of teachers who have been trying to get their bilingual certification in the Spanish language, but continue to fail their Spanish exams because they've never had any formal or academic training in the language. They've only had it in the home setting.
Yeah, we hear about that relatively often. I would lean into what I said earlier. I mean, I think I have a very dim view of how teacher license credentials, how effective they are. I don't think we have any real evidence that people who are able to pass that formal test in Spanish are actually significantly better instructors in Spanish than folks who are near passing it. I don't want to say we should have no quality controls or that none of these have any value at all. I just think that it is always behooves us, especially when we have a shortage like we do around Spanish dominant bilingual teachers, that we should be building many more pathways, and sometimes pathways that go around that credential in particular. That's just it's just a standard policy move. You've got this credential. Put it this way, right? It would be as though getting a driver's license didn't correlate to knowing anything meaningful about how to drive a car. Now, we know it does. It correlates to some things. You got to learn some rules and you memorize some of these things. But the credential itself, we found out that people who never had a license could drive just as well as people who can, you know, we would probably have to start thinking, like, we either need to change our credentialing rule quite a bit, or we need to come up with just a different credential. And I think that's really where we are on a lot of these, especially in the bilingual spaces. We just haven't meaningfully built a system yet that produces quality. It's just really good at keeping people out who we need in the classroom. I would say one other thing on this, which is that the coolest thing that I've seen in the last couple of years in this work has been that, unlike 10 years ago when I was doing this, you're starting to see districts that have been at dual language long enough that you hear stories of people, like graduates of their program, finishing their teaching training and coming back now to teach in bilingual settings. I mean, some of the states that have really well-established bilingual education programs could have told that story for decades, but dual language is starting to get to that level of permeance at this point.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I know that we've mentioned a number of times all the reasons to be pessimistic, but I am optimistic about the expansion of dual language programs and the, you know, what I like to say is like a generational readiness for this. I feel like we are definitely shifting from, you know, seeing language assimilation as quickly as possible as like the goal. And seeing the benefit of speaking multiple languages. And I think, you know, what I can speak from my experience as a Latina, that I think, you know, a lot of our parents possibly had experienced overt, direct discrimination, barriers, different experiences that made them want their children to go into the English monolingual mainstream as quickly as possible. And I think the conversation is just different now. So it will take some time, but we're definitely seeing that shift, and it's something to be optimistic about. I also wanted to share, you know, we've really had a lot of great examples of some of the things that are elevated in this report and the implications for policymakers and educational system leaders. But a majority of our listeners are caregivers and teachers of children with bilingualism in their bones. What can they learn from this report? What do you hope they take away from it?
So yeah, I really could not agree more with what you said about this shift in the culture. And actually, like, this is a good jumping off point to what I said before. Contrary to the internet, after I wrote this Atlantic piece, I'm not opposed to young, white, English-dominant children getting access to another language. I think it's great, in fact. And this is where privileged people do have, a value. We can be really uniquely valuable. Showing up and caring about multilingualism is a good start. It actually does help structurally and systemically if this becomes a meaningful value for English-dominant Americans. If they start thinking, yeah, it really is cool and interesting and worth it to learn about other cultures, to learn other languages, just to participate maybe in them, and a little less to take them away. I don't say steal, but to consume them. So, right, that's one point of optimism. I think that one of the things that dual language immersion offers, there's actually a really great article by an advocate in California named Lori Olson. In the aftermath of English only launching in California in the late 90s, she wrote this article explaining that maybe the way to sell bilingual education again was going to be rebuilding it instead of in an equity and civil rights lens, but building it in terms of these things I said before, global citizenship, these sort of one-off lines like monolingualism is the illiteracy of the 21st century, right? The notion that you sell multilingualism to a broader coalition of people in order to get it back for the purposes of equity and for the purposes of equality. I think that's part of the role that privileged folks have. As far as caregivers and educators working with a wide range of populations, this report, I think, I want to believe, it's a down payment. It's the beginning of a shift in the field back towards dual language as an equity first paradigm. One. Two, it's to remind everybody that when we talk about equity in these spaces, a lot of the times we talk about what I think are a little bit of second order concerns. We talk about shifting mindsets or decolonializing teacher bias or things like that, which I think matter a lot. It's just that they matter less if there are no children of immigrants or Spanish dominant kids left in the school because we didn't attend to the big structural forces outside of the school in the first place. So I think that that's part of what we have to be paying attention to, is looking at equity as a big structural problem and as an in-school mindset and culture problem. I think the last thing I would say for caregivers who care about this is to keep attentive to your own heart on this, right? Again, like, I did study abroad in Barcelona. I do drive a Prius. I wrote for and read The Atlantic. I have a copy of it right here. My wife reads The New Yorker. My kids are in these programs that are almost not Title I anymore because they're getting so privileged. And it is easy as a researcher who works on this for a living to say, well, look, like I showed up when this is a very different school and it sort of changed around us. And that is both true and not a get out of guilt-free card. The next step for, I think, a lot of us is to keep thinking about, okay, so when we're in these spaces, what does it mean to be here? Does it mean quickly running to get in charge of the PTO and making sure that as you take it over, you up its fundraising and you slowly take over all of these things. The next thing you know, it's funding special care packages for teachers and it's doing all of these things that are not fundamentally about equity. Or is it about learning to be in the school and just listen and just take a back seat and just be a member of the community who is contributing just as a member, not as a savior? That's always a good starting point. And then I think the last thing, this is something you referred to a few times that I haven't talked about, is we should be thinking about dual language and equity in ways that aren't only about language. We haven't gone deep on this yet, but African-American students are often left out of this conversation. We talk about English dominant balancing with Spanish dominant. Usually we mean white and we mean Latino. It doesn't have to be like that. In fact, it isn't like that in the United States. So finding ways to ensure that when we talk about linguistic integration, we're not leaving out racial, socioeconomic, or ethnic integration, that's really critical as well. And frankly, like, watch this space. The Century Foundation's actually on our way to putting out a couple more pieces along those lines soon about overtly about race and dual language.
Yeah, definitely. So much I want to dive into there. We'll see how much we get into. But, you know, as you were mentioning about Lori Olson's work and the shift that we're seeing in the conversation around multilingualism, we do see it as like a shift away, maybe sometimes, from equity first language to multilingualism from all. Multilingualism is a good thing. And it makes me think about the role of interest convergence in this whole situation. And had not white middle class, upper middle class families seen the value of multilingual education, would we be where we are today? I'm not sure. I probably don't think so, given the nature and dynamics of the United States. And that's challenging to think about. And I think in the space of dual language education, multilingual education, we as an organization at Bilingual Generation say that we're unapologetically here to support heritage language speakers. And that's a broader category than just English language learners or, you know, students that are, you know, Spanish dominant or Mandarin dominant. And I think we have the perspective of, like, if we design for that learner in mind, everybody benefits from that. Like, it is not going to hurt your white middle class student to have curriculum or to have learning experiences that center the identities of these marginalized groups, because that hasn't been happening for so long. And we often say, like, we know that dual language is important because of X, Y, and Z, but also a core aspect of our work is because our humanity is enough, because it's been stripped from us for so many generations, linguistically and culturally, and restoring that is enough of a reason to do what we're doing. So I look at what you're saying about, like, the dynamics and the interest convergence, and I think there's still something there in terms of unapologetically acknowledging the history that's gotten us to where we are today and centering the identities of students that have been marginalized for so long in these spaces.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I keep coming back to it. It really is okay to be a white English dominant family in these programs. And yeah. So, you know, one of the things is it's a tragedy of the commons issue too. If you ask them, this is what I said before, folks like me, we are usually in this space really well-intentioned and in it for a lot of good reasons, if not maybe exactly the reasons I wish we were. But it's tragedy of the commons in the sense that everybody wants to be the white family, the English dominant family that makes up the, like, 49th or 50th percentile of the enrollment. just the one. We're the one that balances it out. Nobody wants to be the one that starts or even deepens to where now you're the 75th or 78th percentile English dominant and has pushed out all of the rich Spanish language dominant kids that you wanted in the, you literally were attracted to the program to spend, send your kid to attend the school with. The challenge is, you know, nobody gets to pick who got there first and what rate there is of colonization or gentrification or just diversification, depending on the sort of state of the school. So that's the challenge, right? Is that, and I don't want to let us off the hook individually, but collectively, we are the problem. Individually, no one can control that stuff. You want multilingualism for your kid. You care genuinely and authentically about it because of experiences you had, because of things you see coming down the pike, whatever. Maybe because you genuinely care about school diversity like I do. It doesn't mean that you're off the hook for the system-wide stuff. It just means that it's okay to have both those things be true at once. And if you can, especially if you are involved in dual language advocacy somewhere, you need to be preparing very carefully about what you mean when you say you want more dual language. Or what does it look like if we're going to have, say, your elementary school is growing up into the secondary level? What tracking will there be in place? Who will get to take which classes in which languages? When you're advocating for something, is it because it makes it possible for your kid to hoard more opportunities? Or is it because it's actually what's best for the school and for all kids, or especially for the historically marginalized kids in that community? I mean, that kind of reflection is tough. And it's also, as a parent, you're hardwired to try to figure out what is the best thing for your kid. And then as much as you can, set it up for them. Every parent's trying to do that. So, you know, if you're going to be an equity-minded, privileged person in these spaces, you're going to have to fight against that current in your own heart a little bit.
Wow. Okay. Highlight, underline that. That is the question. That's the question. And I think it's a question for, you know, white English-speaking families in these settings, but anybody that carries any amount of privilege, right? Because it's an intersectional perspective that, like, maybe it's the case that you come in carrying this privilege of language and identity, but in other spaces, you may be privileged in a certain way. And thinking about the collective first, thinking about equity-minded perspectives first, how to be a good co-conspirator is just a great way for us all to get better, for everyone to do better rather than individually. And as you said, it can be really hard because it goes against our instincts as parents to try to give the best for our kids. But it really is the best for our kids when we all do better and we create equitable systems that they can live in and that we model that behavior for them as well. So yes, double click on what you just said. And you know, I think it's so important to have really reflective, thoughtful co-conspirators in this space who understand the context and who are leveraging their privilege in really important ways. I mean, we started this conversation with the impact of the language that you're putting to this of colonization. And I will say that, like, we as an organization say that we decolonize language learning. And I cannot tell you the amount of times that we get pushback from, you know, different advisors or different funders or different, you know, stakeholders in the space that are like, do not say colonization, like, don't, like, take that word out of your vocabulary. And it's a different thing for someone like me to say the word colonization and that we're decolonizing than also someone like you to say colonization and to write it, you know, in The Atlantic and to have it in reports at the Century Foundation. It allows a space for us to have that conversation in a more mainstream type of way, and it in some ways begins to make it safer.
I hope so. I mean, I'm grateful to hear that. I have a complicated relationship with some of the terms on this, in part because in the narrow world I work in, there's almost like a whole tenure pursuing industry of publishing articles rethinking the language we use around linguistic equity, right? Like when I started this, the first team that I started, we called the Dual Language Learners National Workforce or National Work Group, because it was dual language learners was the term we were going to all get behind instead of limited English proficient or English learner or English language learner. We're going with dual language learner because it emphasized the two languages that or more that kids had at home. And we started this, and I swear to you, inside of a month, I got emails from people in the field giving this pushback, right? That was excluding, and it wasn't the right term. We needed to instead use something like emerging bilinguals or multilingual learners. And you know, in subsequent years, those terms have become more used and also come under new fire. There's a degree to which if we put half of the energy, though, like the 8 or 10 or 50 of us that are in this space that we spend on adjudicating terms into just demanding better stuff, more resources, better policies, I think we would get more. On the other hand, it does matter the words we use. They absolutely matter. And so I've been wrestling with this throughout my career. To what degree do we need to sort of stop and figure out the term first? And I'm suspicious that we would never get there because we're just going to endlessly argue about the term. Or to what degree can we kind of go forward with the tools that we have? I don't know. I genuinely don't know the answer on that.
I could go on forever about this conversation, particularly around the language we use. That could be a whole nother episode, as you said, that I'm probably one of those people that's like talking forever about what are the words that we use. But I'm very, very grateful for everything that you're illuminating with your work, for your research, for the conversation that you're having here with us today, and for sharing that with me and with our audience. Connor, as we close out our podcast episodes, we always like to ask our guests, what is bringing you joy these days?
All right. Well, so I thought about this a little bit today because it snowed in Washington, D.C. The last couple of days. It's the first real snow we've had in years. And I love it. It's made my I have gone from really in a bad mood earlier this month to just so happy now because it's beautiful and pristine and there's guys shoveling and my kids have been throwing snowballs at each other and I don't know why. I love it. So there's that. I can also give you a totally more topical answer, which is to say, so what's giving me hope though is that I feel like I have this one voice basically when I'm in this space and it can be kind of self-righteous and it can get very morally rigid and it can also be self-flagellating as a white progressive who cares about these things. And so the thing that gives me hope is that one, first of all, we screw up all the time in my house. Like as a family in these spaces, we're trying our best and we mess up a lot. And so what gives me hope is that knowing that each day you get up and just try to keep your moral compass pointed towards seeing the problem that you're part of and also seeing the problems that you're fixing when you can. And then also watching my kids who are now, the oldest is about to be 13 and has been in a program, a dual language program for 8 years, watching the way that he navigates questions of language, ethnicity, nativity, socioeconomic background and wealth, and his younger sister and our youngest child, or my youngest son, like watching the way that they're going is it's going to be hard for them too, because these are not easy. It's never going to be easy, but it's much easier for them. They're just instinctively better on these. And not just these questions, gender too, orientation, like so many different elements. It's cliche to be a middle-aged dad seeing joy in the children and hope in the children. But it's cliche because it's true, because everybody feels it because it's real. And I think that's where I would answer.
Yes. I feel that way too on so many levels. So, wow. Thank you so much, Connor, for sharing your joy and hope with us and for being on the show today.
Yeah, you bet. Anytime.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. If you liked what you heard, take a minute to share this podcast with a friend or colleague. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast platform. Your ratings and reviews help us to keep the podcast lights on. We can't do this without your support. Every subscription, share, follow, download, and review makes a big difference and helps others find our show. Also, we love hearing from you. Tell us what you think of the podcast. Email us at hello@bilingualgeneration.com. You can also slide into our DMs on Instagram at Talking to Grandma. If you are interested in learning more about our workshops and curricular tools for schools serving multilingual and emerging multilingual students, visit our website at www.bilingualgeneration.com or write us at hello@bilingualgeneration.com. Talking to Grandma is owned by Bilingual Generation. Rebecca De Leon is our editor and producer. The artwork for Talking to Grandma was created by Nancy Guevara, and I'm your host, Dr. Veronica Benavides. See you next episode.